Good morning. First case of the morning will be Judith Volosevic versus State of Wisconsin. Mr. Andrig.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Rex Andrig and I represent Judy Volosevic, the appellant in this case. Good morning, counsel. I've had about 3 months or so to think about this case since I filed these briefs, and since I was a bit of a latecomer, wasn't trial counsel, I've continued to absorb and try to process the facts and try to determine, so as not to be repetitive, what areas I would emphasize more if I could prepare those briefs again. Since part of what Ms. Volosevic needs to establish in this case is that there were similarly situated males who were treated more favorably than she was, I began to focus more on the written performance evaluation. And what I discovered and wanted to make this court aware of is that most of the male employees received performance evaluations which were somewhat similar to those Ms. Volosevic received. And some received performance evaluations that I believe a jury could infer were actually somewhat worse than hers were.
Mr. Andrick, were any women promoted at the time that the 11 male employees were promoted?
You know, that's a good question, Your Honor. When I looked at this record initially, I scoured it and tried to determine whether that had happened, and I didn't find any evidence of that. And then when I read the department's brief, I saw that they had not referenced that occurring as well.
See, what I'm wondering is whether whether she was the only woman eligible for promotion.
Well, what I discovered was, in reacting to the argument that the department made on in their response brief was that there were other men who were not promoted, and then in reacting to that argument, I had made a comment in my reply brief that there had been no other women who were promoted. Probably less than 2 or 3 hours or so after receiving my reply brief, I received a call from Ms. Volosevic, and she said, "Mr. Andrig, there was one other woman who was promoted." And I asked her, "Where is that in the record?" And she went back and she said she couldn't find it. What I did find was a performance evaluation in the record of another woman who was in the EEF position, which is the position to which she aspired and was passed over for promotion. So there was a woman's name. So I believe there was one other woman who was promoted, and so there was 11 male and one female who were promoted to that position.
What time period are we talking about?
Right.
This would have been in 1993.
Well, aren't we confined here to this last appeal, last claim? There were two filed with the state agency that were resolved and not challenged after that. No filing with the EEOC. In fact, this wasn't even filed with the EEOC, but I guess the other side has waived that. So we're down to the last claim, aren't we?
Well, I didn't. I don't believe that was an issue that was raised by the department. Okay. I believe we have a sort of a continuing pattern of conduct here, and although the last claim may be the only thing that's before the court, I think the evidence leading up to that last claim is certainly relevant and can be tied into this last claim.
Well, it may be some sort of reference that the specific, whatever you want to call it, adverse action or whatever, has to be in the last time period, doesn't it?
Yes.
We don't know much about the overall statistic. I don't know how relevant they are, but in terms of how many males and how many females were there in the,
I think that all
really in the Department of Agriculture, but at least in this general area, is that, do we have any numbers on that score?
If you're referring to the question of how many males and females there were that were perhaps eligible for these positions, I would agree. I think the record is not real clear on that. I think all we know is that when this position opened up, there were 12 spots to be filled, and they filled it with 11 men and one woman. And Ms. Volosevic was eligible but not promoted.
Now, you were talking earlier about ratings that she got. That isn't the same thing. There are a number of incidents that she reports where she was reprimanded or whatever for not doing the job correctly, and she attempts to prove that she did do it correctly. How probative is that kind of evidence? Is that sufficiently comparable with what would have happened to a man in the same circumstances? What weight can we give that kind of evidence?
Could you repeat the question? I'm not sure that I understand.
Well, there are a lot of these incidents, I don't know what, where she was told to, you know, clean up some spill somewhere, and then after she did it, somebody reprimanded her and told her she didn't do it correctly. I don't remember the names of all these. What does that probe? Does that establish anything about sex discrimination?
Well, in terms, certainly it's probative to the question of satisfactory job performance. I think your question is whether it's probative to whether or not similarly situated males were treated differently. And there's really no evidence in the record to suggest that similarly situated males received this kind of treatment. Again, I think the evaluations are helpful in this particular regard. There at the record is the record document is number 50, which was the affidavit of James Wendland, and they were appended to those to that affidavit as exhibit 6-19. And I draw the court's attention specifically to the evaluations of Mark McCloskey. That's exhibit 7. Russell Bernstein is 8. John Peters is 9. Michael Brown is 11, and Jack Darling is 14.
John Peters, for example? Apparently received some training that she would have liked to receive, but she didn't receive. Is he significant for any other purpose than that?
He's significant in the sense that if you look at the evaluations, what they'll reveal is that he had a very stormy relationship with management, leading his supervisor to state that he didn't think Mr. Peters understood the concept of voluntary compliance or education, even at one point saying he may not be capable of performing his duties as an EES. The following year, there's a remark about him having a poor attitude and unwillingness to follow policies and procedures, uncooperative with management, and so forth. And yet, he was promoted to this position and allowed to remain there. I think it's probative in the sense that when you do a comparative analysis of his evaluations with Ms. Voloshek, I think his, in many regards, are worse, and they're sort of the same types of, some of the same types of complaints that are raised with regard to her, but some that go beyond that.
Mr. Andrek, is there any disagreement whatsoever regarding her claim that her performance reviews rated her at or above standards or at job standards during the relevant time period?
I don't think there's any dispute in that regard. I think from the time she started until I believe it was the 95-96 evaluation, she was rated at or above job standards. And the 95-96 one, it was at job standards, and then it kind of went down after that point in time. I think it's also relevant to note in regard to the retaliation claim, because in some respects I think that's a more difficult claim for Ms. Voloshek to make out. But I would point out that prior to 1993, June of 93, when she filed that first claim with the state, there were really no, I don't believe the record contains any kind of criticisms of Ms. Voloshek's performance. And after that, by August of that year, we see the first memo put in her file criticizing her performance on a particular incident at a school. And then it's later that year when her supervisors are overheard talking about how they need to document and see what they can do to get rid of her.
Mr. Andrek, I really hate to show my ignorance in front of this throng, but what is a Tyvek suit?
I believe it is a sort of a tight-fitting suit that is meant to keep out any kind of chemicals or biological or pesticidal materials. It's something that would be put on by like a hazmat team in order to protect the body from any kind of exposure.
But in, I mean, in what way is the reference to a dye-spec suit a sexual reference?
Well, that's a reference in the sense that I believe that a jury could infer that those remarks were, you came into our office to discuss whether or not you were going to be promoted. Perhaps had you worn this tight-fitting garment,
it's not a tight-fitting garment.
Things would, may have gone better. Well, that's what, that was my understanding.
I know, I had a picture of it. It's actually, I'm sort of curious about that too. It's very loose-fitting. It's like a big overall. It's very unbecoming.
Well, then.
But I guess it protects you if you're in hazardous material.
I see.
Anyway, that was in, I'm really perplexed here. You're talking about stuff that is ancient history, but with regard to this case. We really, you know, I'm not even sure that state agency has jurisdiction over retaliation. And there was no filing with the EEOC on retaliation. I really think this is perplexing. Now, I know the other side hasn't challenged this, but this is a Title VII case, and the EEOC is a preliminary requirement that can be waived, not jurisdiction.
I understand, Your Honor, and
but we do have time limits, and even with the state agency, you've got to file within with the EEOC within 300 days. Assume the suit was filed as well within 300 days of the activity, and if nobody challenges the EEOC, it's a waiver, I guess. But we don't have 7, 8, 9 years history here.
I understand that, and I think to that extent, I by the time I came on the case was already actually the brief was already due, but and I can't speak for why trial counsel chose to pass over the EEOC, and I understand that the court may feel that some of the facts that are somewhat ancient at this point in time, have maybe minimized relevance, but there's no way that we can bifurcate what happened in 1993 and try to understand what happened in 1998. It's just all part of a continuing series of facts. So I see that my rebuttal time light has come on. So I'm good.
Mr. Sweeney?
May it please the court, counsel. My name is John Sweeney. I'm from the Wisconsin Department of Justice, and I do represent the department in this case, and I was trial counsel also. And if I may address the questions that have been put to my opposing counsel, Judge Mannion, I believe you are correct. Anything that happened in 1993 was treated very sparsely at the district court, not as a claim. The 1993 alleged promotion was not in fact a claim, but there was a single proposed finding of fact presented by the defendants at the district court level as a matter of background. The only things that are relevant in terms of claims are those that have flowed from the 1995 and thereafter claims filed with the state and the federal agencies.
Go ahead.
Both those are resolved.
Yes, they were.
But not appealed.
No, they were not.
Why are we going back even that far?
Well, we took the case as it was presented. We tried to cover all of the bases. The main question,
did you file any affirmative defenses like EEOC and time limits?
Timeliness, I believe that's generally always filed, Judge. Whether or not it was dealt with at the district court level, I do not believe it was adequately, nor was it dealt with at this level. A good question. One of the reasons your initial question was what was brought up, I believe, at the district court level regarding the alleged promotion. If you will note in the record, there was a single proposed finding of fact on that 1993 issue, because it wasn't a claim. It wasn't an issue in the second amended complaint. And she was, Your Honor, Justice Robner, I believe the only female who was, according to this record, considered in 1993, but I don't believe that that is an adverse employment action which is before this court. It is, as I believe you said, Judge Mannion, ancient history.
Here's my problem, Mr. Sweeney. If her reviews rated her at or above job standards at all the relevant times...
And I would interpret that to be 1995 forward.
Well, did her reviews rate her at or above job standards?
She was at or above, but as the district court pointed out, there were indications each and every year of where she was lacking in her performance.
Yes, but her reviews, the written reviews, are rating her at or above.
At or above, that's correct.
Then we have a genuine issue of material fact regarding whether she was meeting her employer's performance expectations, because she doesn't need to prove it at this point. All she needs to do is raise a fact question. She's done that. You don't deny these evaluations. And that would seem to be the end of the matter for summary judgment.
It would be the end of the matter, Your Honor, if we were looking at a promotion. But I would suggest to the court, after 1995, let's look where is an adverse employment action where her performance became an issue.
Well, you maintain that she didn't, that she wasn't promoted along with the 11 men because she did not compete well.
That was a single line.
That is compete well. That's the very definition of a conclusory self-serving statement. What are the criteria for competition? What were her scores? She claims that she had more seniority than any of the men. Than one of the men. One of the men promoted and higher test scores than another of the men that were promoted. So, in other words, that would be objective evidence that would defeat summary judgment.
That evidence that you're speaking of, Your Honor, has to do with a single proposed finding of fact, defendant's proposed finding of fact number 7, which was presented solely for the purposes of the 1993 action, and as I've indicated before, that was not really a claim. We were doing background on that particular employment action, if you will. That statement that she was not performing well, let's look at all of the alleged adverse employment actions from 1995 until her termination. And frankly, there isn't one. There isn't an adverse employment action in that entire record.
How about these vociferous criticism that she received at various times as to various jobs that she undertaken?
Well, just about every employee, I assume, was criticized.
You know, 3 or 4 of those.
Is that an adverse employment action over the space of 4 years?
That's what I'm asking.
Your question to opposing counsel is, how probative is it that she said that she was right in this particular instance, that that criticism really wasn't deserved, that what Mr. Delgado said to her regarding the computer, that those were in any way an adverse employment action? This is not a Title VII harassment case. We're not talking about a hostile environment. And I suggest to you, Judge Cudahy, that all of those instances, not one of them, nor do they collectively add up to adverse employment actions. As you've asked opposing counsel, how probative is it that she disagrees with her supervisor about a particular environmental
it's
spill?
It's very probative when an employer actually admits that it gave her ratings at or above standards or at job standards. Then it becomes very probative. Her statement then is not a conclusory statement. It's backed up by objective evidence. We're at summary judgment stage. And we draw all reasonable inferences in favor of the party opposing summary judgment. And that's the problem here.
And I suggest that the emphasis is, as we've said in our brief, on reasonable inferences. Not every inference, as counsel has suggested, but those that are reasonable. And I again suggest to the court, we have to look at what she claims are adverse employment actions. As we've said, we're not looking at the promotion of the 11 males in 1993. We're looking at criticism from a supervisor. We're looking at her challenging her performance evaluation. These are not adverse employment actions. And
Now she overheard a conversation in which it appeared that her supervisors were attempting to create a paper trail that would justify their alleged discriminatory action. Why isn't that enough to cast doubt on the honesty of their belief that she was performing poorly? Because once again, at this stage, we draw all reasonable inference in favor of the person.
I understand, and I agree. And I believe that the conversation to which you are referencing was something allegedly overheard by a co-worker. Her name was not mentioned. Allegedly, it was said, you have to make a paper trail, which obviously is a standard personnel action. No reference to this particular plaintiff, no reference that there was any type of animosity during that conversation to Ms. Filofsek. It was simply a one line out of an alleged conversation, and it was in 1992.
That's your view of it. That might not be a jury's view of it.
It was in 1992
or 93, I believe she alleges, about the time this alleged promotion came up.
But you've waived the time problem, haven't you?
Was that an adverse employment action, that particular remark? Was there any indication that any incident, I think call that what this court has called a stray remark. Is it related to any type of personnel action, or is it contemporaneous in time, which I believe is your standard? All of those things that we've talked about, the remarks, the criticisms, I think have to be categorized as stray remarks. And unless they're within time, contemporaneous, and related, they're simply not relevant.
Let me take you somewhere else, because you didn't respond to her claim that the state advertised that the EES position required a college degree.
That's correct. There was a proposed finding, in fact, at the district court level, in which two supervisors have stated that it was never applied. It was, and I cannot contest the fact that it was printed on the announcement, college degree required. There was never any indication of any position for which this plaintiff applied or anyone in the department when that standard was applied. And there's no indication that she didn't apply because of that standard. That's similar to some of the things that have been argued in plaintiff's brief, saying she was forced to live 25 miles away.
I'd like to ask a question about that. There seem to be two incidents that are involved there, and they seem to be confused in the briefs, one of the briefs anyway. As I understand it, early on, she was asked to move into her own district.
Right.
And later on, they said, well, we're going to put you in an office, not in your home.
That's correct.
And then they originally gave her an office that was 25 miles.
If you look,
those are two separate items, is that right?
They are, and they appear to happen years apart. What happened, I believe, Judge Cudahy, is, and the plaintiff pleads in her complaint, she was told she had to move 25 miles away. And then she went about making arrangements. But in the brief, I believe counsel concedes that she never had to actually pick up and move because the request that she has made was lost, it was processed, and as a matter of fact, she never had to move 25 miles away.
Well, in the first one, she said she had to move into her district and the man didn't.
That's correct.
Is that correct?
That's also 1991, and frankly, as Judge Stadmuller found, it never happened. And the counsel has never claimed in his brief that she had to pick up and move, and that's the fact. I believe that it's important in reviewing this entire record to focus on What is the adverse employment action that Ms. Volovsek is complaining about, and to interpret the record in that light? I suggest that there is not any adverse employment action, nor is there a scintilla of evidence regarding gender discrimination that would support her claim of pretext. And finally, on retaliation, I believe the district court judge was correct. There's no causal connection between her protected speech, which we admit is protected speech, and any adverse employment action.
That's on the retaliation?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, well, of course, it doesn't have to be a causal connection.
It can either be close in time, or there has to be some connection. It's not simply that I complained in 1993 and in 1998 something happened to me. Thank you, sir. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Mr. Andrick?
Thank you. With regard to the issue of an adverse employment action, I think it's also important to note that throughout her entire stay with the department, Ms. Volovsek was periodically requesting promotions and repeatedly being denied. And she wanted to be promoted not just to the EES position, which was a full step up, but she also believed that she was entitled to be promoted to the agrochemical specialist hyphen objective. There were three levels of agrochemical specialists. One was entry developmental, which is where she was and remained the whole time, and a step up to objective. And the record will reveal that she did that every year in conjunction with her performance evaluation, and sometimes in letters to administrators at the department. With regard to the conversation that was overheard, that was in, about creating a paper trail, I wanted to clarify that was in late 93 or early 94. It was by Robert McGregor, and it was also his impression in his affidavit, he states, that they were discussing Ms. Volovsek. Unfortunately, the affidavit is devoid of any additional detail of why that was his impression, but that it was his impression is in his affidavit. I would also note, to clarify the issue about her moving, the situation there was that when she began working with the department, she was living in Milwaukee. She was assigned to Germantown, a district that was about 25 miles away, and she was told she had to move there, and she did. And her contention was that there were a couple of other males that she was able to identify who the department had accommodated so that they did not have to move from their house into their district. And in one instance, they were allowed to remain living outside their district. In another, a district was recreated or reconfigured to allow it to be in his the area that he lived. Thank you.
Okay, thanks very much. Case will be taken under advisement.